The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast for April 27th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. Well, it's been how many days, Jackie?
More than 40.
40?
Yeah.
40 days and 40 nights?
Yeah.
You know, since we've been in somewhat self-isolation. And so how are you faring?
Well, you know, I do find I'm getting into the routine. It's not like it was the first few weeks. So it's really, I mean, there's some good things about it. It's like super efficient.
Yeah.
No commuting time. I can work all the time. I don't have to take even lunch breaks anymore. So,
well, I find that's the stressful part of it, that it is just like meetings and calls are back to back and there's no time to just, you know, when you're working downtown, you can get a breath of fresh air by walking to a meeting and let your mind relax a little bit before the next meeting. And these back to back is just really kind of exhausting.
Well, that's the one thing I am finding is that you're not moving very much and you don't even realize it. Like when you're working downtown, you walk, even within your own office, you walk a fair amount, right? So I'm finding, and I've actually talked to other people that are having like a lot of back issues and things like that, even if you have a decent chair, because you're just not active. And you actually have to force yourself to get outside because you get so caught up in what's going on that it's really hard to kind of step away, I find.
Yeah, it is. So we try in my family to go for a walk every night now.
Yeah, and you got to get that outside time, right?
You got to get the outside. It feels really good to get out. Now it's spring, the weather is getting better, and it's starting to feel better. But still have occasion to watch the occasional movie
in the
evening with all the streaming video and so on. And so this week we are going to do our first movie review.
First ever movie review. We're going to talk about Planet of the Humans, which is a movie which was executively produced by Michael Moore. And it's hard not to notice this movie. A number of listeners brought it to our attention, but everywhere I look on the internet, I see references to it now.
Yeah, no, it's a movie that's making a lot of waves, and so it should. It brings about a lot of interesting points. And it's from the perspective of a fellow named Jeff Gibbs, who's a longstanding environmentalist. You know, Michael Moore movies typically have Michael Moore in it. He's not in it. He's just the executive producer. And Jeff Gibbs, a self-avowed environmentalist who became disenchanted by what the hypocrisy and misguided ignorance of the movement, I guess is the way I could put it. Certainly that's the way it's portrayed in the movie. And so he goes about doing a number of interviews and following the, not only the environmental movement, but the whole renewable energy movement. And so the documentary narrative flows through the fallacies with solar power, then wind power, spends a lot of time on the travesty of biomass, deforestation, desertification, then sort of concludes with, I would say, a bit of an anti-capitalist overtone. And, you know, Jackie, I mean, it's a pretty depressing movie.
It is. Like, I know we're all not in great moods right now, so I would give a warning. If you don't want to get more depressed, you may want to avoid it. But at the same time, I think a lot of people in the oil and gas industry have found it refreshing in that it does bring some facts about renewables that aren't all what is accepted.
If you're thinking that this is a pro-oil and gas movie, think again, because, I mean, it makes some pretty strong anti-fossil fuel tones all the way through. It really is about the nature of upstream energy from whatever source, and really says what I've been saying for a long time, certainly in the books that I've written, is that nothing in the world of energy comes for free, comes without any environmental consequence. There's always environmental consequence, whether it's solar or wind or any of the sources. And it makes a lot of points on that. It also speaks quite a bit to the problem of unsustainability of population. But we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that. Why don't we go through some of the sort of the highlights and just talk about them? I mean, I think that there was some key moments early on, you know, the validation that we're not really transitioning at all to renewable energy, that for every joule of renewable energy that we install, there is another joule of energy from fossil fuel that's brought. So actually, it's more of an energy diversification that's going on.
Yeah, and you've been saying that for a long time. I mean, as we've increased the amount of renewables, we've actually increased even greater in terms of the amount of energy, the use of fossil fuels. They also talked about, which I think is interesting, a lot of these green solutions are actually fueled by hydrocarbons. So for example, biofuels from corn ethanol, agriculture is still fueled by oil. And to create the corn ethanol, you'll use a lot of natural gas in the processing. So it gives the illusion that you have a green product. But actually, if you look upstream, and this has been proven by the California Air Resources Board, that the greenhouse gas emissions associated with corn ethanol are no better than oil. But there's that belief that it is green.
No, I mean, there is a very large expose of the whole biomass, biofuel genre of energy. And, you know, a lot of people don't know where their upstream fuels come from. And then if you take it even one step further removed, what goes into making those biofuels is even further removed from the consumer. Like, you don't really know what's going on. And I mean, there's been many studies from the past that show that the amount of energy needed to make a joule of bioethanol is greater than that joule of ethanol. In other words, you need more energy to produce the energy that you ultimately use.
Yeah, if you think about all the fertilizer and the energy for all those upstream inputs.
And they take hydrocarbons. So there's really nothing in the world of energy that comes from free of environmental baggage. And that's a really, really core message of this movie.
Well, and they were really hard on biomass. So they talked about groups like 350.org that has really promoted burning wood for energy.
Yeah.
And there was one quote, if we burned every tree in the U.S., it would be energy for 1 year. Yeah. Like, it's just unsustainable to think we could use wood for the kind of energy needs the earth has in it today.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, there's countries in the world, many, including Canada, where a lot of people burn wood in wood stoves. And that's fine. I mean, a lot of these wood stoves are high efficiency wood stoves. I mean, countries like Norway, for example, a lot of people burn wood for their heating in the winter. Mm-hmm. But the use of wood for industrial power generation, I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. And there's some pretty shocking imagery, videos, segments that show, you know, wholesale chopping of trees down just to put inside power generation, which is an extremely inefficient process.
Right. And then it takes, what, in North America, it can take 50 to 100 years to regrow those trees.
Yeah,
So it may be greenhouse gas emissions equal because you think that tree had to absorb CO2 over its life, but it's not sustainable because of the time associated with growing the tree. They were really quite critical of wind and solar. Solar, they basically said, is created by mining rock and coal. And there's a lot of energy used to create it. And then they also went on to say, you know, in many cases, when you go put all these solar panels in, you actually are degrading the environment in the place that you are. So you may be taking out trees, or in the case of a desert, making it so that it's now more susceptible to erosion. And so we're not thinking of the whole picture sometimes.
No, I mean, the amount of energy required to mine the silicon, and also, by the way, mining coal that goes with the silicon and making a solar panel, is quite staggering. But it also does highlight the use of arable land. And so they've got these images of chopping down 500-year-old trees to make room for a solar farm. And really, that's quite disturbing, in my opinion. I've always said that the energy density of a solar farm is very low, and that you are making an environmental sacrifice in arable land. Unfortunately, they didn't really show the benefits on top of, say, rooftop solar.
I know. That's the thing I was thinking of. You know, in cities, I agree, we shouldn't be converting like agricultural land or even desert land, because that is an ecosystem that is getting disturbed. But we could put solar panels above all the concrete we have in a city. Why not have, you know, the big Walmart parking lot? Why not have a roof over it that's all solar panels?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think the movie was sort of parsing the worst of solar and the worst of biomass and the worst of wind, I mean, if there was any failing. But having said that, you know, I'm okay with that, because I do think sometimes you need to whack people over the head to show them this concept that nothing in the world of energy comes for free. And I think that the environmental movement has really sort of portrayed an image of green energy being a panacea for endless amounts of cheap, free, clean energy. And the movie makes that point, I think, quite well, that there is no panacea.
Well, yeah, I do think that one of my criticisms is it wasn't completely balanced. And I am more hopeful. Like, it made you feel like there's just no hope here. We're going to be destined to be using hydrocarbons and not be able to reduce the use. Like, for example, they had the example of hydrogen and talked about, oh, well, it's all using natural gas to produce it. Well, they didn't talk about the fact that there are new technologies, like you could use solar or wind, and actually hydrogen could kind of almost be a storage, where you store the energy by creating hydrogen from those renewable sources. Or there's new technologies that could actually take natural gas and turn into hydrogen and then create black coal. You know, so it isn't like the technology is static, and there are solutions, I think, that are more sustainable. They didn't talk about nature-based solutions. They didn't talk about geothermal at all. They didn't talk about mini nukes that we've talked on our podcast. Yes. So they kind of cherry-picked ones that are problematic and not really showed the potential that's out there.
But I'm okay with that, as I said in this movie, because I think that we really need, and I'll sort of repeat this, to whack people over the head, to get them to realize that what goes on in the far upstream where we can't see what's going on in terms of environmental degradation, not just emissions, it's not all about emissions, it's also about the reckless use of arable land, the reckless deforestation, and all those sorts of issues that tend to get dismissed. And I think that in many ways, yeah, there's no question. The movie cherry-picked the worst of, but sometimes you need to do that to wake people up.
Well, and you know, they showed like the pictures of the mines that are associated with producing batteries. That's something people don't see,
right? Don't see
that. There's obviously a lot of hydrocarbons involved in doing that. The other thing that it talked about, which I think is really valid, is the misinformation out there. So they showed like rock concerts that claim to be 100% renewable. And then in the background behind the stage, they're running all these diesel generators.
Yeah, there's a lot of inconvenient truths. I mean, it exposes how the notion of being 100% renewable is really not achievable anytime soon. It's got to be backed up by the grid. The grid typically runs off of natural gas and other sources, including coal and nuclear. And so the idea that we're going to be able to have overnight magical energy storage and solar and wind being powering rock concerts or entire companies is just not on.
Well, and in some cases, there are straight out lies, right? And I think they highlight that, you know, or tree huggers that are actually, you know, into burning trees and creating power generation using trees. But why do you think the environmentalists do that? Why do they stretch the truth to that extreme?
Well, at one point, the movie talks about that, actually, Jackie, that Jeff Gibbs sort of questions and says, what are the environmentalists and their allies hiding, in quotes? And is it ignorance-driven? Is it misguided? Is there a hidden and duplicitous profit motives? Well, it dives into each one of those things. And I tend to believe that a lot of it is not malicious. I tend to believe that there's a lot of ignorance and a lot of people just do not take the time to really understand what goes on far over the horizon, where all the mining and deforestation and all that stuff goes on in typically in foreign countries where we have no grasp of what's going on, that feeds into the energy systems that we call here even upstream. And then by the time it gets to the light switch or the gas pump or whatever we use, it's completely hidden from our day-to-day lives.
Yeah. I mean, these are fairly smart people, though. I think they should see like, oh, well, what goes into a battery and is this really sustainable? I mean, I have another theory that wasn't in the movie, but I just believe that a lot of these people are so worried about climate change that they feel like these little white lies, if you want to call them that, are okay because we need to get this industry up and going. And we also need to raise money so that we can get to a scale that we need to get to.
Yeah, I do think that there is a faction, a large faction, that would fall into that category, that they're trying to push an agenda. But I think that also brings about something that really was emphasized to me again, and that is that an excessive dependency on a one-dimensional environmental strategy of, say, reducing emissions at all costs actually costs. In other words, the drive to reduce emissions from fossil fuels is leading us to make reckless, bad decisions, actually, as the narrator says, you know, why are we making bad decisions about the overall environmental predicament that we're in this as a planet? And I think that that's really, really important when we think about environmental policy as it relates to energy going forward, that it has to be holistic. And I think that it's been one-dimensionally focused on emissions, you know, net zero by 2050. Okay, net zero emissions, right? That's the narrative. I personally think that, okay, it's got to be net zero from an holistic environmental impact rather than just the one-dimensional emissions.
Right. You can have no lower emissions, but then have air quality or water quality issues or, you know, forest
deforestation
issues.
Deforestation and all the rest of it. And the movie does a good job in highlighting all the different potential issues beyond emissions.
Now, the title was Planet of the Humans. So another narrative in the movie is that the population is out of control, and that is the root problem here. As humans, we need to realize that we need to change our lifestyle. We cannot have the same lifestyle with the amount of population we have. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of a narrative about, you know, need to reduce the population. And as you know, most projections are that population does start to flatten. We go from about 8 billion now to maybe about 9 or 10 billion by 2050. But that's going to mean that energy use generally will go up if we don't get more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Well, this narrative about too many people has been going on for 300 years. So it's nothing new. We've always been able to figure out and adapt to the situation. I do have a sense, and I do agree with some of the people that were being interviewed in the film, that we are approaching a very unsustainable tipping point with the number of people and the draw on resources and overconsumption. But I was a little bit disappointed in the movie in a sense that they didn't talk about the potential of energy efficiency, right? The efficient use of the energy. And I think that certainly I've written about this in my second book, The End of Energy Obesity, that energy efficiency is a key area to focus on because our energy systems are so incredibly inefficient. I mean, I actually saw some numbers recently that from source to usage, we actually only use now 10 to 15% of the source energy. I mean, it's staggering. In other words, 85% of the energy in that tree you chop down is completely lost.
Right. And a lot of that's to do with combustion, right? Because so much is lost to heat.
It goes up a smokestack, lost to heat. And so the push toward energy efficiency is really key to being able to sustain energy consumption by 8 billion plus people.
Well, and here's a great example. Like in North America, we love the big cars. If we all drove very tiny cars, we could probably have three times as many cars and still use the same amount of oil.
Actually, right? Four. I mean, the environmental impact of a large SUV is four times that of a small passenger car.
Another thing I didn't like about the movie is that when it came to this Planet of the Humans or the population problem, it didn't talk about solutions either. I'm going to put a link to this in the show notes, this Project Drawdown, and they put a list together of the biggest impact actions that we could do to reduce climate change. And the top two are not anything most people would even put on the list. Number one is in the areas of food and agriculture, land use and land sinks and managing all that. Mm-hmm. This is like nature-based solutions and doing agriculture better. That's the number one thing we can do. The number two thing is actually health and education, specifically education for girls, which will curb population growth. And they basically said that women with more years of education have fewer and healthier children and manage their reproductive health. They have more wealth and they think more about the environment. So the number two thing that we can do, according to them, isn't getting off fossil fuels. It's educating women so that the population numbers can start to flatten out and therefore this ongoing growth in human demand slows down.
Yeah, I think that the film deserves a sequel that builds on what they've done. And, you know, one of the things is, toward the end that the narrator talks about is the need to create awareness, such as you're saying, but it doesn't really talk about specific actions that can be done. I think that action, especially on the consuming end, especially on energy efficiency, which leads to also conservation, which is not using as much if you don't need to, something we're living right now in the crisis, right? I mean, I think people are conserving a lot more given the uncertainties of the future and a new way of living. And so all these things need to be taken into account. And so, you know, on balance, I appreciated the candor of the movie. I know it has a lot of people up in arms, but we need hard-hitting movies like this to expose what goes on behind the scenes. And sometimes you need the extremes to slap people over the head and say, wait a minute, like, nothing comes for free in this world.
And it maybe creates that curiosity when there is a solution put in front of you. You don't just blindly accept it. You think about, well, what are the upstream impacts? Hey, by the way, I did a bit of a back of the envelope calculation, and I'm going to put a link to this on the podcast notes because I had this thought, like, you know, we're going through such a hardship right now. People have made drastic changes in their lives. We're not commuting to work. We're not flying. And I was thinking, we've probably made our 2030 Paris target. For sure we have.
Well, you'd think. Yeah. Everybody's staying home.
So looking at the IEA Sustainable Development Scenario, by 2030, we would need to drop our emissions about 23% from the 2019 level. I calculated if we assumed we were using 30% less oil and about 5 to 10% less power and natural gas, emissions would only be down about 15%. Mm-hmm. So even with the kind of restraint and lack of activity that we have today, you couldn't even make the Paris target. It just shows how hard it is to make that. And honestly, in 10 years, after watching this movie, it just reiterated, I don't think technology is going to save the day in 10 years.
Not in 10 years. We've got to be able to figure out better ways, being more responsible with our energy use and applying technology to the lowest hanging fruit first. And there's plenty of that out there that we'll talk about in subsequent podcasts.
Okay, well, let's talk about some other topics to finish up the podcast. Now, last Monday when we had Bobby Tudor on, we had done that interview in the morning before we got the minus $38 oil price. And so we just wanted to quickly talk about that very historic event.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Lots has been said about this, so we don't need to reiterate it, but basically it was driven by traders unwilling to take physical delivery of WTI. It was a very small amount of contracts. In fact, for the May contract that was trading that day, it was less than 7% of all of the trades that were done below zero. So it wasn't like every barrel in North America traded. But it does show that there's some real problems with storage. And I had been talking that there was still a lot of space in storage that was empty. But what we found out on Monday is that it may be empty, but it's owned by people and it's not available for any market participant that wants
it. So it's hoarding of storage.
Yeah, exactly. We hoard everything when there's a shortage. Yeah. And we're seeing more and more examples around the world of storage constraints. And so what is this going to do? It's going to cause shut-ins to happen faster. Today, we're, I think, just above $10 WTI again. It improved a bit last week, but it's down again today. Like, that is not sustainable at WTI, nor is it sustainable in the Bakken or Western Canada or even in the Permian.
So let's back up to that idea of the hoarding of the storage.
Whoever owns it now realizes that it is super valuable and is not going to let people use it without a large price tag. You know, what did you see on Monday? Actually, that's effectively the price of storage. Someone said, yeah, I'll take that oil. I have some storage, but you'll have to pay me $38.
Sure.
Like, you know, it's now a very valuable resource, more valuable than the oil is the storage to put it in.
Right. And we know that they're also using tankers and even now smaller petroleum product ships to store the oil. And the rates for hiring those ships is gone through the roof too.
Yeah. In the end, storage is going to continue to be at a premium until we see shut-ins and balance this market. That's the ultimate solution here. And I think over the next month, we already had announcements even last week, some big U.S. producers saying they were going to shut in a lot of their production. And that's what's going to have to happen.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to do it. So as we said on a few podcasts ago, the sudden demand drop has rippled all the way up the pipeline. The price has gone negative, which is a screaming siren that says shut in. Producers are shutting in as we speak around the world, not just here. It's affecting the inland producers more. Meantime, on the consumption side, the lockdowns are starting to ease in certain countries and certain states in the United States. And so the demand is going to start coming back up. But I don't think it's going to come back up fast enough in the next couple weeks to offset this dynamic.
Or even a couple of months, especially with the inventory full. Yeah. But I agree that we bottomed, especially in North America. We've had demand almost the same for 3 weeks of data now. And I think, if anything, we're seeing relaxation, not more strict protocols in terms of lockdowns.
So would you call the bottom then on the price? Do you think it's going to go negative again?
I think it will go potentially negative again. The bottom on the price isn't there yet because we still have demand quite low and storage is full now. Right. And so it will take some time, I think, over the next few months to get this market closer to balance.
Yeah. I think the forward market is really looking to July, August before we're really out of the woods on this.
Yeah. No, I think it's still going to be some pretty challenging times, but it'll be nice to see those demand numbers coming up. But they're not going to go anything close to back to where they were initially.
Yeah.
Let's talk quickly about the federal government. It was a couple of weeks ago. We haven't talked about it on the podcast, but when the Canadian federal government announced some support for the oil and gas industry, $1.7 billion for reclaiming wells, $750 million for loans to reduce GHG emissions with a focus on methane. So what are your thoughts on the program?
Well, as many people in the industry would say, it's a good start. It definitely is biased towards the smaller independent producers, which really is necessary in my opinion, because the small independent producers typically are on the non-oil sand side and they have the bulk of the employment that stretches from Northeast BC through Central Alberta all the way into Saskatchewan. So in that regard, I think that it's a good start. I do know that there is talks going on in the background in terms of the big companies and how those ones, you know, many of those are too big to fail. Mm-hmm. And I think the government realizes that. How it all shakes out, I don't know.
But, and you're talking about the loan programs.
Yeah.
Yes, we didn't talk about that. There's loan programs as well, more for the small to medium companies.
Yeah.
But potentially there'll be something maybe for the larger companies as well.
We'll see how it goes over the next few weeks. But, you know, this is with so much of the oil, as we just discussed, being shut in, potentially, what, a quarter to a third of all Canadian production? I mean, it's going to have
It's not there yet, but I think that's probably where we need to get to. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a possibility. Mm-hmm. So this is pretty devastating on the dominant export business in this country. I mean, under normal circumstances, with, say, a $50 per barrel oil and none of this going on, it's a $120 billion a year export business to the United States, dominantly.
Yeah. We want to make sure we have a business. It's a bit like the coffee shop or the restaurant, right? Like, if they shut down completely and they don't do anything for 6 or 8 months, it's going to be very hard to restart these businesses. Maybe have debt issues, supply chain issues. If you can kind of help them along and allow them to continue to have some parts of their operations going, they'll be able to restart sooner.
Right.
Now, I will agree with you too, by the way, that the reclaiming wells and the GHG emission reductions are probably more on the non-oil sand side as well.
Yeah.
And I actually put a tweet out when this came out supporting it. You know, not only are we focusing on reducing our environmental liabilities, but we're putting people to work. These are actually two projects that you can get people, Albertans and Western Canadians, working right away on. There's not a bunch of time necessary to get this up and going. And the methane is substantial. Methane is about 25% of all the GHG emissions from the oil and gas sector. So we, by reducing the methane, you can actually make a big difference. Now, I had a bunch of negative reactions to my tweet, basically saying, you know, polluters should pay, taxpayers shouldn't pay for the industry to clean up their environmental liabilities.
But from a let's put this in a total Canadian perspective. The GHG emissions from wells, the fugitive emissions, is about what, 7% of all Canadian emissions?
Yes, that's what it works out to.
7% of all. And it's relatively cheap. I think it's like $10 a ton.
10 to 20. These are literally some of the lowest cost emissions
it's like low-hanging fruit.
Economy.
Yeah. So I sort of did a back of the envelope calculation that $750 million, okay, we're not even into the $1 billion range, which I mean, so many of these programs are in the billion plus range across the country. For $750 million, you can effectively, in very short order, reduce Canada's total GHG emissions by 7%.
Yeah, or get a big chunk of that. No, I agree.
I mean, this is some of the lowest hanging fruit. Some of the most intense GHGs are the methane. And to be able to remove them quickly, I mean, I think this is in everybody's interest. And I think that's a pretty compelling program with the objective of reducing GHGs as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it's a win-win. And by the way, the reclamation of wells, it also can help reduce liability for the province, but also the companies, it can actually help with their debt situations because it does factor into how much debt they have.
Right.
Okay, very quickly, I want to give you an update on the Enbridge plan to contract the mainline. We've talked about this a number of times on the podcast. And just for background, the Enbridge mainline moves 70% of all exports from Western Canada. It's a 2.7 million barrel a day pipeline. They want to switch it from open access, where anyone each month can put their oil down to it, and it's been that way for the last 70 years, to have it contracted for 8 to 20 years. And many of the supporters for this deal are dominated by U.S. refiners and companies with interest in the U.S. The people that are opposed are generally Canadian producers. In fact, the majority of Canadian producers are against this, from the biggest, Suncor and CNRL, to the smallest, the EPAC group, which is a group that represents smaller producers in Western Canada. Now, the producers have come to the Canadian Energy Regulator and said, we want a six-month pause in this hearing process about this contracting. Because of COVID and the oil market collapse, it's very challenging for producers to work on a hearing right now, not only because they're got physical problems, like physical distancing means it's hard to collaborate and get all this work done.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the oil market collapse has made it very challenging because companies are very busy with just operational issues and financial issues. And so that's the question put in front of the regulator.
Yeah, I think it seems like a no-brainer to me. This is a very consequential hearing. We talked about it in previous podcasts. It basically takes a pipeline that is open access to a multitude of producers and almost turns it into a small oligopoly that shuts out a lot of producers potentially. So, you know, at this time when you can't sit across the table and have conversations, when everything is upside down, it just doesn't strike me as a good time to be making such far-reaching and consequential decisions about the future of how we export this commodity to the tune of, I don't know what the 2.7 million, but it's
2.7 million barrels a day. I know.
So, you know, multiply it out and you'll see this like billions per year of export, and making a decision on that right now does not seem to me making any sense. So I hope they defer it.
Yeah. So Enbridge and their supporters, of course, want the hearing to go forward. The producers want it to be delayed. We're going to find out probably in the next 3 to 4 weeks what the regulator is going to do. But I agree with you. This is a very consequential decision, and I don't think it should be done in the worst oil market we've seen in the history of Western Canada.
No, and one that actually affects that pipeline. The whole system is out of whack.
Yeah, it's a bit of chaos.
So why would you embark on a discussion to effectively sort of oligopolize the pipeline at a time in sort of chaos? It doesn't strike me as good sense.
Okay, well, we're going to find out, and we'll give all our listeners an update in the next month or so when we find out what the decision is. Well, with that, I think we've covered a lot of topics.
Yeah, well, you know, I have a new respect for people who do movie reviews because it's not easy to do. But no. I would definitely say if you're in the energy business or peripheral in the energy business, certainly if you're wondering about environmental impacts of upstream energy, then Planet of the Humans is the movie that you need to watch, if for no other reason is people are talking about it.
Yeah, you might want to have a drink before you watch it too, just to deal with the stress.
Yeah, don't, but it's certainly the ending especially is depressing. And I would just say that there are other ways of being sustainable than taking all the negativity of the movie verbatim.
Yeah. There's definitely some solutions to some of those problems. Okay, with that, thank you, listeners, for joining our podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.